Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining editor Simon Lambert and I today is reporter Will Kirkman. And today we're talking property, getting in and moving on, living to 100, and whether your pension will last as long as you do. Simon shares his top tips that could bag you big, and we don our flares and we go back to the 70s. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.
Now, coming up, we'll be talking about how much you really need to buy a property, but selling one doesn't exactly come for free. So imagine if you could do it without paying a penny of commission to the estate agent. It could potentially save you hundreds, if not thousands, of pounds. Well, the country's fifth largest estate agency, web-based House Simple, is offering to do just that. A market-first, free-of-charge service. They've already been trialling it in Yorkshire in the northwest, and they plan to roll it out further afield over the coming months. So it sounds great, but what is the catch? Is there one, or am I just being cynical, Simon? How much could this save you, typically? And where does the money go to? Break it down. Estate agent fees.
Estate agent fees. They can be anything up to 3%. However, they are more likely nowadays to be around about 1.5%. And they may or may not add VAT to that.
Right.
You will pay with VAT, but some estate agents do a sneaky thing where they quote you their charges and then it's plus VAT. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, that seems a little unreasonable because as a consumer, I, as someone who is selling my home, do not get to reclaim the VAT back off someone else, which is the only reason why you would quote a price as something plus VAT. I don't have a choice about paying the VAT, and I don't get to reclaim it back off someone else in the VAT food chain. Anyway, rant over.
Okay, that's fine.
So you're looking at 1.5%. If you're looking at 1.5% on a £250,000 house, then you are looking at £3,750. Is that correct?
I was going to say, did you do that off the top of your head? Because that's impressive.
£2,500.
Someone get the calculator out.
Plus half of £2,500 is £1,250. Yeah, £3,750.
And that, Simon, is why you do what you do and do it so well. Anyway, so that's a lot of money, basically.
Yes.
For what? What are we paying for here?
Well, you're paying for the estate agent to market the property.
Right.
So they'll come round, they'll measure it up, they will do a floor plan, they will take some photographs, they will write up an advert.
Now, is it harder the bigger the house and that's why they get more money percentage-wise? Or
No.
Oh, right, okay.
No. They will then advertise it for you. That chiefly nowadays on Rightmove and Zoopla, which are the main property portals, and there's also one called On The Market, which is has been floated on the stock market, but was actually created by estate agents to try and rival the dominance of Rightmove. Most people go to the internet first, to Rightmove, primarily, to search for properties. You might, if your estate agent is an old-fashioned kind of guy or girl, get yourself in the local newspaper. Get a photograph in the local newspaper. And someone once explained to me that one of the main reasons for... You don't tend to get these big, chunky local newspaper property sections anymore. You tend to get them in more like the Times has its bricks and mortar on a Friday, the Sunday Times home section.
Yeah.
You've got the Telegraph's property section and things like that, where they have the individual property section, Homes and Property in the Evening Standard. As I asked someone, why do estate agents put the houses in there? Because surely, does anybody end up buying a house from seeing it in the Sunday Times? They're always the really, like, expensive houses
say,
in the Sunday
yeah.
Times. And they explained to me that actually it's not really about that. It's not about selling houses. It's about attracting sellers. So what they put them in there in the shop window so that other people with big, expensive houses, when they think, I'm going to sell my big, expensive house, they go, ooh, Savills or Fine and Country made them look really good in the property pages. I'm going to go with them. Anyway, so what you get for your money is you get your property listed and then an estate agent will come around and show people around the property. They will negotiate for you to try to get you the best price. And then they will manage the sale all the way through to the point where you exchange contracts and then it's finally sorted, you complete, and the new people move into your house and you hopefully move into another one. Now, a traditional high street estate agent will tell you that this is a good service that they provide, that this costs money, that you can't do it on the cheap, that your home is your most valuable asset and you want to get the best possible price for it. And so you need someone on your side doing all of that work to a very high standard. The only problem with this is that anybody who has ever dealt with an estate agent will realise quite soon that a lot of them don't actually provide this amazing service that they bang on about. And I would say a lot of them are quite rubbish. So if you get a really good one, then they're probably worth their weight in gold. But a lot of them aren't really good. And into this gap has stepped the online estate agent with the promise of undercutting people with flat fees rather than a percentage. Because as you said, is it more work, hard selling a much bigger property? No, not particularly. And in fact, it can be less work. Sometimes more expensive and bigger properties are in higher demand. They can sell themselves. But certainly once you go up the food chain, and particularly, I mean, for example, if you were going to sell in London, you're staring down the barrel of paying an estate agent £9,000 to sell a fairly ordinary flat or terraced house.
So you said there, into the breach stepped the online estate agents, and we're going to be talking about House Simple soon, but how have they fared? Because didn't we get the collapse of eMove last year, I believe it was?
Yeah, eMove went bust at the end of last year. They've since been bought and relaunched, what was left of them anyway. How are they faring? Well, they've got a market share of about 7%, and I think that's dipping.
It doesn't sound huge, does it?
It's not huge,
when you
no.
Think they advertise themselves as cutting costs quite substantially.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons to be pessimistic about that market. Purple Bricks shares drops, eMove's gone bust, Property Ombudsman has seen a rise in complaints. So there's all sorts of reasons for that. It's funny you mention eMove. I actually spoke to Russell Quirk yesterday, who's the founder of eMove, about this House Simple thing. And he said, I'm quoting Russell here, he said, take it from me, charging too little and merely relying on commission from third parties is no way near a sustainable business model. So he's obviously not very optimistic that this fee-free service will work.
Tell us more about the fee-free service from House Simple.
Well, so they usually charge a flat fee, like Simon says, because they're an online estate agent. They normally charge a fee of about £995 or something like that. That's all gone. It's going to be free. The idea is now that they'll make their money off third-party referral fees. So if you list with them, sell your house with them, and then they recommend, for example, a home insurer to you, you buy your home insurance from that insurer, the insurer will then give House Simple a referral fee, and that's how they're going to make their money. It's something that all estate agents do, but this is the first time that an agent has relied on this solely as their source of income.
Simon, what do you make of it?
Well, one of the problems that the online estate agents have is that because they charge this flat fixed fee, a lot of them started out asking for this up front. Now, of course, one of the advantages of selling your property through a traditional high street estate agent who charges a percentage based commission is that actually, unless they sell your home, you won't pay anything. You pay on sale and completion. So you can get them to do all the work that I was talking about before. And if they don't find you a buyer, you can pull your property and you can put it on with someone else, or you can just take it off the market. The problem with if you pay the flat fee, of course, is that you've paid up. Now, there are options with some of them to defer the fee. There are options with some of them who do a no sale, no fee thing. So you pay a higher flat fee in order to do this, so you can list your property for free. House Simple has taken this on an extra step and said, well, we won't charge you at all. Now, I would agree with the comments in there from Henry Pryor that there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, he commented in the article, and if something's free, then you're the product. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, do you want your estate agent to be acting for you, or do you want your estate agent to be acting for all the people who are paying them referral fees? I mean, who's their customer? In a relationship where you're not paying them, someone else ultimately, you know, is their customer, is paying them. So I'd be very wary. On the other hand, I would say there's probably loads of people who, if they do this, play their cards right, they're not being forced to take any of these services that House Simple earns the referral fees for, you could actually save yourself a huge amount of money. I mean, and one of the reasons why the online estate agents are able to cut prices so much is because they have much lower overheads. Running a traditional high street estate agency branch is expensive. So you've got to pay for the premises. You've got to pay the business rates. You've got to pay to keep the premises open. You've got to pay all the people who work in there, who actually for large amounts of the time are sitting around doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Because during the week, people don't tend to be viewing houses Monday to Friday during the daytime. You get a few people doing it. You've got to pay for them, for their cars that they're driving around in. Some estate agents like to pay for branded minis. And all of this adds up. Whereas if you're running an online-only operation and you've taken out all of those costs, you can offer much keener fees. But the two big guns, the main one, as Will said, is Purple Bricks. And that has did very, very well, but has fallen back a bit recently as people have sort of readjusted their expectations. Mainly the share price, because it got completely sort of beyond itself. The other one coming up behind it is Yopa. And Yopa is the second biggest player in the market and equally offers a good service, save you a lot of money. And what they have is that Yopa, for example, has a local agent and they will come round. They will do the work that the traditional agent's representative would have done. And they will assess your property. They'll tell you what you should put it on the market for. They'll do the viewings. You might have to pay extra for the viewings and so on. And they'll sell the house. And you, as the customer, would probably never notice the difference between using them and using a traditional high street agent. The question is, when it comes to selling your home, which one do you opt for? And a lot of people still go for the traditional high street agent because they think, yeah, I could save myself a bit of money, but I think that traditional agent will still get me more for my property.
Well, we like dealing with what we think is people, don't we? Not saying that they don't, because that's one of the big adverts, isn't it, of Purple Bricks, is you actually deal with people. But we do like that kind of...
We do, and we're just kind of convinced that the old system will get us more money.
Especially, I think, for something as big as selling a house with all the emotional weight that comes with that, the idea of being able to pop in and speak to someone face-to-face. It's probably more appealing to a lot of people.
No, I agree. We all know here, sat here, when we look at the polls about the... least trustworthy professions, and that's because journalists are right down there. But we're right down there with politicians and estate agents. And I just think, rightly or wrongly, but they do have a bad reputation. You said it right at the start, Simon, and we're not slamming all of them. There are some very good estate agents out there that are absolutely worth their money. But wouldn't it just be so much better if we just had some... transparency, right? Everybody paid something similar and we understood where our money was going to. And I think that's, for me, one of the big problems with saying that you're not going to charge fees and you're going to get it through other ways. I start to get nervous at that. What do you think about that? And also, do you think, what knock-on do you think that'll have on the wider market? Are we going to be seeing more issues like what Simon said, the plus VAT sneaky little things coming in?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, whether other online agents follow suit, whether it'll actually be a sustainable business model. But yeah, equally, it'll be interesting to see if it actually has good customer outcomes. Obviously, it is a plus that you're saving a bit of money at the start, but is it going to work? Are you going to be pushed products that you don't necessarily need? There's all sorts of implications. What's going to happen with your data? I think that's a point that Henry Pryor made as well yesterday. When I spoke to him for the article. So, yeah, it just remains to be seen how it will work.
Well, as Simon says, you are the product, aren't you? When you say how it works, how's the trial gone and when is it being rolled out? Do we have any more of those details?
There's no time frame for when it's going to be rolled out to the rest of the country. So it's been trialled in the Northwest and Yorkshire for the past few months, and past 6 months, I believe, and they've said that they've had a 5-fold increase in listings. So it's obviously done very well for them. But, yeah, they've not given a time frame, but I assume it's imminent.
I think that the big thing for these online estate agents is getting the brand recognition, because ultimately when people put their house up for sale, quite a lot of the time it's a bit of a random process which estate agent they choose, and they go for the name they recognise or the one that they think looks good or something like that. And so being a name that someone recognises is important. Purple Bricks has cracked that. Yopa is well on the way to having cracked it, and House Simple is probably making a bit of an attempt to do so. If it can get lots of listings on Rightmove and for sale boards outside people's houses, then the effect snowballs.
All right, well, that's selling. What about buying? How much do first-time buyers really need to earn to get on the first rung of the housing ladder? Well, new research shows just that across major towns and cities in the UK, and as you can imagine, well, it varies somewhat. But by how much? Tell us a little bit more, Will, if you would, about the research.
So the research has found, obviously this is on a national scale, but the average first-time buyer or couple buying needs a household income of £54,400 to secure a mortgage on their first property. Obviously, that varies massively around the country. It's very different if you're buying a house in Glasgow than if you are in London, for example. But that's just the national figure. That has increased 9% since 2016, which is due, obviously, down to the rise in house price growth.
That's still, it's 54 as an average.
Yeah, 54 is the average. Deposits have risen as well, but obviously that varies around the country. So in London, you're looking at an average deposit for a first-time buyer of about £119,000, whereas in Liverpool, it's £18,449. So it changes a lot depending on where you're looking at it from. But yeah, £54,400 is now the income you need to secure a mortgage on your first home.
They always, whenever they do this, it's a couples. So if you're on your own, whew, that is expensive.
Oh, yes, it's all but impossible in a lot of places, even the cheaper places, for someone to buy on their own. Even in most of those cheaper places, obviously, people are also earning lower salaries. To do the maths on this, Zoopla's taken average house prices. It's assumed 30% of net household income is spent on mortgage costs to assess affordability, and the mortgage amount is capped at 4x income, as is standard across a lot of lenders. It assumed that buyers would put in a 15% deposit in regional cities, but 25% in London, Oxford and Cambridge. The larger deposits there allows for the fact that otherwise you need to borrow more money, and most mortgage lenders will not allow you to borrow quite so much money. But the interesting element here is that the change between 2016 and 2019, as Will said, it's got more expensive, so you need a higher salary now on average than you did in 2016, except for in four cities. So Aberdeen, Cambridge, London and Oxford do not require people to have more money. And in fact, they have got theoretically cheaper in that sense. And that's because house prices in those locations have come down slightly, but also because mortgage rates have got substantially cheaper. And so the combination of those two things means that in theory, it is now cheaper to buy in London. The caveat to that, as Will said, is that you need a deposit of £119,000. And it would take most people a very, very, very long time to save £119,000. And that's where the bank of mum and dad comes in.
Even then?
Well, exactly.
£119,000.
And this is the issue in London at the moment, is that actually, despite it becoming more affordable, London property sales have collapsed somewhat. People aren't buying, and a lot of that is due to the fact that 3 years ago we were talking about the fact that house prices in London had been rocketing. People were queuing around the block to view properties at the weekend. Stuff was going to seal bids. Everything was going above asking price, and it felt a bit like the top of a bubbly period. And lo and behold, it was. So people aren't buying, and ultimately I think we just ran out of the number of people who could afford those high prices at the time, and ran out of the number of banks of mums and dad that could, you know, fund those purchases. So people aren't buying now. The irony is that actually now would be a much better time for you to buy, because you are going to be able to take advantage of prices that are lower. Sellers who have much lower expectations, most people selling their home at the moment in London would be willing to accept any decent offer. And it's always better to buy at a time when other people don't want to be buying than buy at a time when people are queuing around the block to do so. Caveat being, you need a load of money.
Yeah, you do. You do need the money. And a lot of people will be wondering as well, if we are sort of dipping off a little bit, how far have we got to go? But also, with economic uncertainty related to Brexit, was it just a perfect storm, or I suppose the straw that broke the camel's back, or was this going to happen anyway? Was it inevitable?
I would question the Brexit effect. I think it's a bit limited, other than the fact that what it makes people do is worry about spending a very large amount of money, because they're worried about prices falling, because they've been told prices might fall, and you get a bit of a vicious circle there. There are less Europeans moving to London. There are less Europeans buying in London. There was definitely an element post-financial crisis where a lot of the best and brightest, you know, European minds all decided to move to London, because London bounced back much quicker and unemployment was much lower in this country than it was in France, in Italy, in Spain. And so people, you've got a lot of people coming here. Quite a few of those people have now decided, because of Brexit, that maybe we might head back home. Maybe it's not so great. Maybe we won't buy here. You've got more people moving out of London. There were some statistics showing that earlier this week, especially people in their 30s. Again, some of that was credited to the cost of living, high house prices, things like that. The statistics show house prices in London down about 2% annually or so, and down a few percent on where they were a couple of years ago. Anecdotally speaking, I would say that around where I live, North London, between Finsbury Park and Crouch End, Stroud Green, I would say prices are about 10% lower than they were. So, you know, and those are the things that don't show up in the house price statistics, because, you know, the house price statistics don't get that granular, and also they only measure properties that have been sold. I would say people are asking 5 to 10% less for their properties, accepting 5 to 10% less for their properties than they were. So in theory, makes it a better time to buy, because it's, you know, you're getting it cheaper.
It's a good tip. If you go in a bit harder than perhaps you would do if you're looking to buy from someone.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, it's better to try to buy at a time when other people aren't buying. And who knows, if Brexit gets sorted, what people want is certainty. I don't think people are necessarily concerned about Brexit itself anymore. They're concerned about the continuing uncertainty. You know, ultimately, at some point, we're going to get a new prime minister. At some point, we're going to sort out Brexit. I was speaking to someone yesterday for one of my investing shows, a fund manager, and he was saying that he thinks that, you know, he's investing in the UK, in UK shares and UK companies, because he thinks that it is undervalued, and Brexit will be sorted eventually. And once it is sorted, we'll get a bounce. Maybe you can read across from that to the property market, because as I've said before, house prices are very expensive. They can't stay this far above the long-term average for forever. But banks and building societies are very keen to lend people money at the moment, and usually you get some form of final leg up before prices peak, and some form of euphoria. And other than that little burst that we had in London a few years ago, we have not seen that around the country. So I would expect things to be in the doldrums, and then we get another couple of years run up, and then maybe sometime in the early 2020s to mid-2020s, that's when the whole house of cards comes falling down.
All right, thank you very much, Simon. You mentioned there about mortgages. So we're not going to talk about people looking to buy or sell, but just to get the best rate on their mortgage. If that's you, we might have some bad news, because up to 500,000 UK borrowers have seen their home loans sold onto an inactive or unregulated lender, meaning their mortgage is now owned by a company or a fund that can't offer them a remortgage. So of those, the financial watchdog reckons around about 140,000 would save money if they were able to switch onto a new deal. However, strict rules governing how lenders assess whether you can afford it have left many of these homeowners essentially mortgage prisoners, and even pressure from politicians may not be enough to help the vast majority. Will, this is your story. Take it up.
Well, so the FCA has been looking at these mortgage prisoners for a while. Essentially, before the financial crash, it was far easier to get a mortgage, and lenders were far more willing to lend to all sorts of people in all different circumstances on all sorts of loans. That has obviously since changed. It's now much tougher to get a mortgage. If you want to get one, then you have to pass quite stringent affordability tests where they look at your incomings, outgoings. It's just a lot different these days. So the homeowners that the FCA has been looking at, like you mentioned, these are primarily homeowners who are with inactive or unregulated lenders. They may have originally taken their mortgage out with a bank that went bust during a crash, say Northern Rock. Their mortgages were then packaged up and sold on to companies that aren't regulated to lend, which means they can't offer them any new deals. Some of these customers, the ones that took their mortgages before the crash when affordability tests were a lot easier to pass or a lot different, they now can't pass the new tests for new banks. So they're stuck with these lenders that can't offer them new deals, and they don't qualify for any other deals from any other lenders, active lenders. So that's the problem.
And it seems rather unfair, isn't it? Because I assume they didn't have a say over what happened to that loan.
Yeah, it is unfair, and this is the problem that the FCA has been looking at, because some of these have been keeping up with their mortgage repayments. They're on high standard variable rates. They can't switch away from them, and that's more expensive than a cheaper deal that they might be eligible for otherwise. They just can't pass the tests to get those deals. So the FCA has basically gone to the industry and asked, if we changed our rule book a little bit, so if they're not taking on any more money, if they're not borrowing any more money, if they're keeping up with repayments, can we switch them to a cheaper deal? So basically moving from an absolute test to a relative affordability test relative to what they're paying now. And the banks have come back and said it probably won't work for the vast majority of customers for all sorts of reasons. Number one, we don't know how many of them there are. We estimate there's about 140,000 in this situation. But because their lenders are unregulated, they don't have to report anything about their circumstances. So we don't know how many of them there are, and we don't really know what situation they're in financially. And the banks have said, for all sorts of reasons, that if they're not financially healthy enough to qualify for a good deal, then even if they pass affordability tests, they'll probably end up paying the same as they're on now, so there's no point in switching. Or they're too old, or there's all sorts of other reasons. But the upshot is that this looks like it will only help between 2,000 and 14,000 homeowners, which is nowhere near the 140,000 that the FCA is looking at overall.
Simon, this sounds a quite extraordinary situation, and a bit of a computer says no.
Yes, and I very much feel for anybody in this situation. I'm looking here at an email I've got from MoneyFacts, the financial data specialist, which tells me that the average two-year fixed rate mortgage is at 2.4953% at the moment. Ooh. Now, that is actually lower than it was a year ago, at 2.5261%. And we've had an interest rate rise.
So, and what could some of these people be on?
A lot of these people could be paying 5%.
Yoosh. Okay.
Yeah, so they could be paying twice as much. And obviously that then impacts the rest of their finances.
Of course.
It means that they are on a losing wicket compared to everyone else. And we're not talking about people in arrears here. Mm. We're not talking about people who've fallen behind with their mortgage. We're talking about people who have been paying their mortgage month in, month out, and actually by moving their mortgage, they would be paying less each month. So in theory, that would make it substantially more affordable, but yeah, they've been caught out by circumstance. And as you said, people don't have any choice about it. The people who took out the Northern Rock mortgages didn't choose Northern Rock to go bust. They just took out a mortgage with them. I know someone who had a Northern Rock Together mortgage, which is the one where it was the 125% mortgage. And, you know, they live in the Northeast and their property is still not worth what they paid for it, unfortunately, in 2006. They've managed to clear the extra bit on top of the 100%, and they're trying to sell their flat. And once they sell their flat, they're going to walk away with it with essentially nothing. And we've got the situation recently where Tesco, for example, yeah, said it's closing down its mortgage business, it's going to sell its mortgage book. And there's been a lot of pressure brought to bear on Tesco to promise that it will not sell its mortgages to someone that is an inactive lender and could turn its customers into mortgage prisoners. Because certainly all of those people who took out their Tesco mortgage thinking, oh yeah, I know Tesco, I trust Tesco, they didn't expect to be flogged off at some point. Mm-hmm. So I do think in the scenario where it is a bit computer says no, more needs to be done to help these people, because ultimately most of them would end up saving money. And I think that they've proved over the years that they can pay their mortgage and that should count for something.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Right, let's step back in time, shall we? To the 1970s. Not known as a particularly golden era for the UK economy, high inflation, employment struggles, strikes, and yet this was the last time that the UK enjoyed such low unemployment figures. Now, despite Brexit uncertainty, which we've spoken about already, levels are running at a 44-year low of 3.8%. That's according to the latest figures from the ONS. So what was going on in 1974, one, to make unemployment so low, and how does it compare to now? I was going to say, Will, do you remember the 1970s? But I don't think any of us here really remember the 1970s, do we?
I don't remember the 1970s. I wasn't around then.
You weren't born, were you, Simon?
I wasn't born.
I was born in the 1970s, but only right at the end. There are pictures of me proving that I was in the 1970s, yeah, but I don't remember any of them because I was too young. Okay. Do you remember the 1970s, Georgie?
I wasn't born then either. Yes. However, we've heard the stories. And what was interesting is, Simon, you said a little bit earlier that it got worse as the decade progressed, which has got nothing to do with your birth, I'd like to say. That was the bright spark of the late 70s, obviously.
Yeah. And depending on your views on a certain Mrs. Thatcher, things either then got better or continued to get worse for many of our readers.
Let's not talk about Tories' leadership and the Prime Minister, for goodness sakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was going on back there? Can we draw any parallels from this?
So this rather brilliant article was written by our reporter Emily Hardy, but the inspiration came from the brain of yours truly. Something clicked the last time the unemployment statistics came out. And we get told this every time around because we've had record low unemployment, or the lowest unemployment since, for quite some time now. And it said, you know, for 44 years, so since 1974. And I just suddenly thought, hang on a minute. Why was unemployment so low in 1974? Weren't the 70s a bit rubbish? I keep hearing about how Jeremy Corbyn's going to take us back to them, and it's going to be bad news, not good news. 3-day weeks, strikes, rubbish piling up in the streets, corduroy trousers, that kind
Should
of thing.
Should have put that first, Simon, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I said, can we find out what was going on? So Emily jumped in the DeLorean, the metaphorical DeLorean, and, and went back to the 1970s. Well, it turns out that actually the start of the 70s were pretty good. PwC chief economist John Hawksworth said early on in the decade, we had a booming economy. And that means that throughout the 70s, actually until the sort of the middle of the 70s, stuff wasn't quite as bad as gets pictured. So we had the post-war years were characterised by a bit of a buoyant jobs market. And between 1945 and 1975, the unemployment rate barely exceeded 3 or 4%. And there were two things driving this. Firstly, it was a great period of British manufacturing. We had very strong manufacturing post-war. Secondly, keeping people in jobs was a major, major political concern. Mm-hmm. So obviously, we'd had the war, we'd had the post-war years, the tough years afterwards. Politicians were particularly keen to have low unemployment and keep people in jobs. And also there was the strength of the trade unions, which made it harder to sack people and actually meant that their wages were going up at a decent rate. So you had the government and the union would bargain on wages. So wages between the government and the unions, rather than the unions demanding lots and lots and lots and lots. And that's what we think of. We think of unions going, no, we want more. No, we want more. No, we want more. You won't give it to us. We're going on strike. That was the late 70s. Before that, there was a much better relationship between the unions and the government when it came to wages and bargaining. And they were happy to keep wage demands at a lower level in order to keep unemployment low. So what went wrong? 1973, the UK was hit by an oil crisis. You had the fallout from the Yom Kippur War. You had OPEC, which hiked prices. The inflation rocketed. Once inflation rocketed, people started demanding higher wages. Firms, because they were dealing with very high costs, started to lay off workers. That led to major industrial action. You then had, you know, things like the start of the miners' strikes. All of that meant that the happy consensus was shattered, and the sort of boom time of the early 1970s, when you could put on your corduroy trousers, walk down the dealership and bag yourself a tasty gold Ford Capri, like the one we have photographed in this article, gave way to power cuts, 3-day weeks, rubbish piling up in the street and everything else. You then had the Thatcher era. In Margaret Thatcher's plan, she decided she needed to remake Britain, and she was not as politically concerned about keeping unemployment low. That's when you started to see big unemployment as, you know, large swathes of industry were cut through. And then finally, we then start to get to the decades that we remember much more, the 90s, the 2000s, and so on. And that's how unemployment now is the lowest it's been since then. Now, interesting factoid here.
Yeah.
How much do you think the average wage went up between 1974 and 1975?
Ooh. Are we talking percentages?
Percentage, yeah.
I'll say 8.
8%. Will, do you know the answer? How much do you think it went up?
I'm going to go for a 10.
30%.
Wow.
Okay, this is really interesting. This was an answer to a question to then Chancellor Gordon Brown in 2004, Treasury answer from it that I found in Hansard when I was trying to find out about what the average wage was in 1974. 1974, the new earnings survey data showed the average full-time weekly wage as £41.70, which is £2,168 a year. In 1975, this had jumped to £54, or £2,808 per year, putting wage inflation at 29.5%. So basically pretty much 30%. I mean, this is because inflation was 16% at the time.
Yeah.
Still, that's a 13% real pay increase. I mean, nice. Even if you added all of the last 10 years together, I don't think you get to a 13% real pay increase. In fact, I don't think real pay's gone up in the last 10 years. So it's amazing that, isn't it? And a house. What do you reckon a house cost back then?
What, the average house price?
1974.
I'll say 10,000.
Well,
maybe 15,000, 20,000.
Cheaper, 8,900.
Oh, I wasn't far
yeah.
off.
Yeah, and so that means that with the average wage at 2,168, the average home cost approximately four times typical annual earnings. Mm. Today, the ONS puts the average house price at £229,000, the median full-time earnings of £29,600, and so that ratio is now 8.
They never had it so good, did they?
I know, but what you've got to bear in mind is that people were paying much higher interest rates on their mortgages back then, although the benefit of that was that it was keeping a lid on house prices. And house prices did actually go up at a fair clip in the 70s. So that average house price in 74 was more than double what the average house price was in 1970. Although you do have to also bear in mind, of course, that once you adjusted that for inflation, they weren't rising by that much above inflation. And as I pointed out, wages went up by 30% in one of those years.
Goodness,
there you
me.
Go. Anyway, if you want to read this article and take a trip back to the 70s, it's on the This Is Money homepage and it's on the This Is Money markets page. And you can go in, look at the charts, look at the old pictures of people looking either happy or grumpy and marvel at the gold Capri.
That's really what it's all about. It's the gold Capri, isn't it? My dad had a mustard. I can't remember what it was, but he still goes on about that mustard-coloured topless car that he had. Do we call it a topless car? That sounds wrong.
I think
wrong.
It's a convertible.
Whatever
you're thinking of.
One of those. And he keeps saying, and then we had children. Thanks, Dad. I think it's incredible though that there are tens of thousands of people who back in the 70s were just few years from retiring, still around today, still collecting their pensions. Now around 56,000 people are expected to reach 100 next year, compared to just 6,000 3 years ago. That's according to official projections, and that figure's only expected to increase as we are living longer. But what does that mean for our pensions? We're always asking, aren't we, about how much we need to save for retirement. We'll throw in the fact that your pension may have to last you over 30 years. Eek, Will, eek.
Eek, indeed. Yeah, so it looks like you'll need a pension of nearly £450,000. This study that the article's based on assumed that an average UK salary of £28,000 if you want to retire at 65 and you want an average retirement income, annual income of £20,000, you'll need nearly £500,000 if you want that to last until you reach 100.
That's actually not as high as I thought it would be, because I thought that was really generally the figure that people looked at anyway, Simon.
Well, it seems quite a lot, because we had a story a while back that said you needed 200 and something thousand. So it's nearly doubled since then. But those are two separate pieces of research, thus illustrating why people get a little bit confused here. But this is, as Will said, this is based on the average salary being £28,000, you not needing to replace all of that, but you want an annual retirement income of £20,000, and retiring at 65. Now, of course, most people won't actually retire at 65 in the future, because they won't even get their state pension at 65.
Yeah.
And so what you need is that pot of money to last you another 35 years. That's quite a long time. If you
that
think
is
about
huge.
It,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, because
that's almost like your working life,
you know. Because if you think about it, the 35 years from 65 to 100, if you take that off in the other way, that's from 30 to 65. I mean, you know, imagine not having to work from 30 to 65. It's quite a long period of time, isn't
Very
it?
Very long period.
Quite like the idea of not working. I'd prefer to not have worked from 30 to 65 and then work from 65 to 100. To be perfectly honest.
Agreed.
Yeah, it's a shame that we don't have a government that would fund that. Still, maybe Corbyn will. But and that's allowing for it to rise by inflation. But it assumes that you keep your pension invested in a drawdown plan and that you get 5% investment growth. If you were to buy an annuity instead, which would give you a guaranteed inflation-linked payment of £20,000 for the rest of your life, you will need more money. You will need £670,000. And I should point out at this point that this is based on the average salary of £28,000. If you are on the average salary of £28,000 throughout your working career, it's going to be tough to save £450,000. Yeah. Not impossible, but it will be tough. And obviously, if you're going to be on more than that, then you're going to need more than the £450,000 in order to replace the same proportion of your income.
I think I read The 100-Year Life, the book, and I can't remember who it's by, an economist.
Some dude.
Someone.
Hey, I know, I've seen him speak before, actually. Yeah, he's so really interesting. I think we saw him speak at the same place.
Yes, we did. That is so staying in the podcast. just to humiliate myself. No, I did read The 100-Year Life. It was a very good book, by the way, and I do recommend it. They said that a child born now is 50% as likely to live to 100 as not. So we are living longer. We're going to have to deal with these issues about pensions and stuff and changing work life. And actually what he does really well in the book, which I can't remember his name because there's two people as well, which makes it even worse, is he talks about the changing way in which our working lives will evolve. You know, it's not a job for life anymore. You know, you talked about the 70s. We're not going to get those golden pensions. It's not a job for life. It is about a portfolio career, they talk about.
Yeah, I think people do move around a lot more these days.
I think that's a very interesting point. I also think that was a wonderful insight into the kind of conversations that me and Georgie might be having together if we reach 100. Yeah. Oh, what was that guy's name? Oh, yeah, that was interesting. I saw him speak once. So did I. Oh, yes, we were in the same place.
Yeah. This is a bad omen, Simon, because we've got a long time to go
but
yet.
He talks about having different phases of your life, doesn't he? So you might have, you know, one stretch of a career and then move to do another stretch of a career, you know, in the second part of your adult life. And then when you then reach what were traditionally the retirement years, instead of putting your feet up, going down the golf club, playing with grandkids, you then shift into another phase where you might, no, you might not be not working completely, but you might be doing some work, for example. Be that, you know, if you're at the kind of white collar knowledge end of the scale, you might be doing bits of consultancy, little bits of work here and there. But for people who are doing more manual based labour, that's going to be tougher to continue working doing what they were doing. So they're going to have to find something that they can do because they might not be able to do the kind of heavy lifting anymore.
Different types of work you could be doing throughout your career and training, constant networking he talks about, but also taking that sabbatical. You said you'd enjoy taking the 30 to 60, you know, off and enjoy yourself. Well, actually what he's saying is rather than, you know, 1 year after university, you go on your gap year. And then when you get to retirement age, that's when you swan off on the Caribbean. Well, actually what he's saying is you go through periods of life.
Yes.
And you do have these kind of gap years throughout.
Yeah, which is an interesting theory. However, I'm not sure the employment system is entirely set up for it.
No.
I mean, there are some companies that will offer people sabbaticals or the opportunity to take out chunks of time and things like that. And that's a great way of retaining staff. But there are also lots of companies that if you walked and said, I'm going to go travelling for a year and then I'd like to come back,
when I get back,
they'd say, okay, well, you've got 3 months' notice, and if you give me a resignation letter, you're fine, and off you go. But otherwise, could you get back to work now, please?
Yeah, but then things are changing, so maybe that will reflect in terms of
what
people
obviously
want.
The way that I would like to see this change is I would like to see the education system support this, because the main issue with me going off, for example, for 6 months or a year, I'd quite like to go do another snowboard season, to be perfectly honest, is that my children's school would have something to say about it. And you can actually pull your... Ironically, if you take your kids out of school for long enough, you can do it. You don't run into the whole no absence in term time can be authorised kind of thing. But you then have to have some kind of plan to educate them while you're away, and you're not guaranteed to get your school place back when you come back. So if you're lucky, it'll still be there, but if you're not, it might not. And schools are such a massive issue for people, to the point where they drive where people can live. You know, they won't need to live within certain catchment areas. People won't move to villages and things nowadays because they're worried about getting to schools. So the idea of like pulling the kids out for 6 months or a year, managing to convince your employer, worrying about having a job to come back to, worrying about your kids having a school to come back to, probably means that the number of people taking those midlife gap years is not going to be substantial for the time being.
Still, I like the idea of us sitting having an après-ski in the Val d'Isère or something, doing the podcast. That'd be fun, wouldn't
it? It'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, alas, we dream on. But one thing that could get you, well, I wouldn't say retiring at 30 or anything like that, but you might get a nice wee holiday from it, is if you can win the share picking game. I told you a couple of weeks ago, forget fantasy football, no, this is money, and it's their birthday special. We've been talking about the share picking game. Are we beyond the practice period now? Are we full on gusto into this? Because you can win 20 grand, by the way.
You can win 20 grand, which conveniently would be 1 year's worth of retirement.
There we go.
Yeah, there you
fantastic.
go.
Fantastic.
So we are still in the practice period.
Right.
The practice period finishes this week. The game starts officially on Monday. That is when scoring starts. So all scores will be zeroed at the end of this week. People can then keep the same shares or they can pick new ones. And scoring starts Monday morning. You can still enter the game all the way through until August and still be eligible for the prize.
Wow. Okay.
Obviously, you might think, however, that if you haven't started at the beginning and started racking up gains, then you have less chance of winning. The ending of the practice period, the zeroing of scores, and the starting afresh will benefit certain players, but not others, those who have already racked up big gains. One of the players that it will benefit is yours truly, who is not doing very well.
Really?
Yeah, in my defence, I'm going to say that for most of this period, I have been in testing mode rather than share-picking mode.
Yeah. Which, you're doing it wrong, so you can help other people with the tips.
Talk about making it sound like you're offering excuses
Sam,
Lambert. So I've been doing a lot of making sure the game's working, checking on things, and a lot of that has involved just going to the company's page and then just quickly picking a couple of the companies that were near the top of performance for that day. This has not turned into a winning strategy for me.
Okay.
I was, when I last checked, I was in the princely position of 930-something in the league.
Of how many?
Oh, we've got more than 5,600 players.
That's
at the
amazing.
Moment. Yeah, well, we're hoping for more. So if you've not, if you're listening to this and you haven't signed up to play, come and play. You've got a very good chance of winning £20,000 if you play this game, or one of the £500 weekly prizes for the best pick. What did really well for me was a company called Staffline. I'd like to say that was through my share picking skills and that I will be soon getting a call to take over from a certain Mr. Woodford at his troubled fund. It's not. It's because it was one of those ones at the top of the list that I picked. And Staffline's shares got absolutely hammered the other week when it had some accounting issues and said it was going to have to do a share placing. And then people have been betting that actually that share placing will come in at a higher price than the lower price. And so its shares rocketed. Another one from the top of the list that didn't do me so well was Lookers, which is the car dealership, and that has been struggling in the market recently and has been struggling even more, and that was down 20-odd%. So anyway, I was down, but fortunately, scores are zeroed, and I can start afresh on Monday.
With that in mind, though, Simon, you did do a guide of tips, which maybe we should... Do what you say, don't what you do.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yes,
yes.
that's the ticket.
Yeah, so these are not things that I've done.
Okay, right.
Right, so just to say. keep an eye on the business news. Early mover advantage helps.
Yep.
So read our business and markets section. Look at the RNS, which is the official stock market announcements. They come out at 7 o'clock in the morning. Check the market diary for what's going to be going on. So just keep abreast of what's going on. Watch out for share tips. There is an element where companies that get a buy share tip, their price tends to go up in the days afterwards because people go and buy them. And people also buy them thinking that other people will go and buy them and that the price will go up, which creates something of a virtuous circle. Keep an eye out for Midas, which is the Mail on Sundays tipster. We have that column every Sunday on This Is Money. And read the other share tips we publish and also share tips from elsewhere. Look for momentum. Studies have shown repeatedly that stuff that's recently done well tends to continue to do well in the short term. So this is stuff that's done consistently well over the last month, for example. Have a look at our market data. Look at the top movers section. You can set that to a month. See what's done well. Have a look at the share price graph. Decide whether you think you're going to back momentum and think that this effect could work. Watch out for profit warnings. Mm-hmm. Basically, people are divided on when a company issues a profit warning and the share price falls sharply, whether you should then just get out immediately or whether you should hold tight and wait for recovery. There is an old saying that profit warnings come in threes, and so if it's the first one, you might want to jump out. Again, run your winners, cut your losers. Again, this is an old investment adage, but do you want to bank gains or do you want to run your winners? Do you want to cut your losers or do you want to wait for recovery? Decide on your strategy and do that. And also, don't forget that you can play in private leagues, so you can set up a league to play your friends and family and colleagues.
Goodness.
So, Georgie, an email invitation will be winging its way to you. So you too, like 932 other people, can beat me.
Come on. I was just looking at you there because you're sagely doing it. And when you're talking about something quite serious, you start stroking your beard.
Yeah.
So you can hear the kind of crackle of your stubble as you sagely give this advice about share. Yep. There you go. I'm going to do it. I'm going to sign up. I've never done a fantasy football, so I feel like I should do a fantasy share with a chance of winning something.
Very easy to play. Yeah.
And it's just going to be, can I beat 930-something? Anyway, do go online, find out more information, get involved in this, get email updates, all that sort of jazz. Stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Simon Howe.
thisismoney.co.uk/game for the share picking game, or come to This Is Money, or email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at This Is Money, and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to see all podcasts past.
And download the app. And if you like this podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.